This week's parsha, Parshas Vayakel, is a very important parsha when it comes to the laws of Shabbos. And in general, Shabbos is something that is extremely significant in the context of the entirety of Torah. In fact, Shabbos is mentioned so many times throughout the pages of Chumash. We begin with Maaseh Bereishis, in the very end of the creation of the world. We know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu already instructs us about Shabbos. Vayichudu HaShemayim V'Haaretz. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in the very end of creation, already tells us about the importance and significance of what Shabbos needs to mean to all of us. And Sefer Shemos, we have Shabbos mentioned many, many times as well. In Parshas Beshalach, when the Torah talks about the man falling, in Parshas Yisro, when it talks about the Aseres Hadibros, obviously we have Zacharias Yom HaShabbos L'Kadsho, and then once again in Sefer Devarim, in Parshas Mishpatim, the Torah talks about Shabbos once again, after the Chet HaEgel in Parshas Kisisa. Last week we spoke about Shabbos, and this week in Parshas Vayakel and Pukudei, we have mention of Shabbos once again in the context of the building of the Mishkan. You go through Sefer Vayikra and Bamidbar and Devarim, you count up all the different times, it seems that Shabbos is mentioned at least 15 or 20 times throughout the pages of Chumash. The Nevi'im emphasize the importance of Shabbos as well. And the challenge with the laws of Shabbos are that the Gemara Maseches Chagiga tells us the following statement, that Hilchos Shabbos is one of the areas of Halacha that is Kehararim Hateluyim Bisara, which means it's like a mountain that's hanging by a thread. What does that mean? What it means is Shehein Mikra Muat V'Hilchoseha Merubos, which means there are so many intricate details of all the different halachos that govern our observance of Shabbos. But if you look in the actual psukim, you don't really get all those details. You have very few psukim, and from those psukim, we learn a whole chelik of Mishneh Berurah, chelik gimel, that tells us exactly how to observe Shabbos. So it's very hard to get it directly from the psukim. However, there are so many halachos that we need to be aware of. And the Mishneh Berurah writes in his introduction to the third chelik of Mishneh Berurah that unless a person really delves into the halachos of Shabbos, there is no way that you can possibly go through an entire Shabbos properly. It is simply an impossibility. If you don't know the rules, how are you supposed to know how to observe it properly? And therefore, he says, it's really important that we all take time to make sure that we familiarize ourselves with the very comprehensive and wide-ranging laws of Shabbos as we know them to be. Interestingly, the Torah makes mention of only four specific malachos. So we're all familiar that there are 39 different categories of malacha and then subcategories of those categories, but basically 39 of us malachos, 39 categories. But when the Torah describes the different prohibited activities on Shabbos, we only have a mention of four. What are those four? Anybody know? So the four are, in Sefer Shmos, Perek Lamed Daled, Pasuk Chaf Aleph, the Torah says the following, Sheshes Yamim Ta'avod, Uvayom HaShvi'i Tishbos. So far, we know that. But then it says, Becharish Uvakatsir Tishbos. What is Chorish and Kotzer? That is plowing and harvesting. So the Torah specifically makes mention that when we rest on Shabbos, we're supposed to rest from Charisha and Kitzira, which means plowing and harvesting. Why does the Torah mention these two in particular? What about all the other malachas? Why doesn't the Torah say that on Shabbos you have to make sure that you rest from the malacha borer? Make sure you don't do any of the other 37 malachas. Why does it mention these two? This is the question of the Ramban on Chumash and the Ibn Ezra. And the answer that they give is because today we're not so familiar with this, but in the times of the Chumash, what were the basic livelihood, the basic parnasa of everybody? All they were able to do was work the fields, or they were shepherds. So the Torah says specifically, you're not allowed to work the field. Becharish uvakatzir tishbos, even though it means that this is what your parnasa depends on. Even though we know that this is the most essential and basic necessity of a family, to have a livelihood, to have an income, and everything depends on it. Still, the Torah says, Becharish uvakatzir tishbos. It's not that these two malachas are any more important than any others, but it's because I may have thought that malacha doesn't apply to these two because I have to make a living. And what the Torah goes out of its way to teach us, Becharish uvakatzir tishbos, is that of course, we have many malachas on Shabbos, but these two in particular, one needs to be vigilant about, because I would have naturally said that, of course, I'm allowed to work on Shabbos in order to be able to support my family. The Torah then gives us, in Shmos Perek Lamed Hei Pasuk Gimel, another malacha that is uniquely mentioned, and that is the malacha of Havara. Torah says, Lo suvaru eish b'chol moshvoseichem b'yom ha-Shabbos. Torah says, you're not allowed to light a fire. So why does the Torah specifically make mention of Lo suvaru eish b'chol moshvoseichem? That is a major discussion in the Gemara. What is special, what is unique about the Malacha of Havara? And the answer to that is because when it comes to teach us, the Gemara Masechet Shabbos Daf Ayin says, the Gemara here, the Pasuk here, when it says, Lo suvaru eish, comes to teach us a specific halacha that really sheds light on all the other malachas. Say, for example, says the Gemara, somebody was b'shogeg on Shabbos, violating many malachas. What does that mean? It means I wasn't aware that today is Shabbos. I think today is Tuesday. And it turns out that it was really Shabbos. And I do all kinds of malachas throughout the duration of the day. Why wouldn't I? How many karban chatas would I have to bring? I didn't do it b'mezid. I didn't do it on purpose. It was all a mistake. It was all b'shogeg. And we know the halacha is, if you do a violation of Shabbos b'shogeg, you have to bring a karban chatas. You have to bring a karban to the Beis HaMikdash. How many karbanos would I have to bring after that Shabbos? I somehow managed to violate all of the 39 malachas. How many would I have to bring? Says the Gemara, I would have thought that all of them should be included in one karban chatas. Why? Because all I did was I violated this category of malacha. Says the Gemara, no. From here, from the fact that the Torah specifically mentions Lo suvaru eish b'chol moshvoseichem, it means that each malacha by itself needs to be looked at as its own entity. And therefore, when you violated all 39 malachas at Shabbos, it's not as if you violated one category, it's as if you violated 39 categories. The same way Lo suvaru eish b'chol moshvoseichem is its own category, so too each of the 39 malachas are considered to be their own category, and therefore, if you ended up violating multiple malachas on Shabbos b'shogeg, you will have to bring a karban chata separate and apart for each one of those malachas that you did. That is learned from Lo suvaru eish b'chol moshvoseichem. The last malacha that is mentioned in the pages of Chumash is in Shmos Perek Dazayin Pasuk Chavtes. And there the Torah says, in the context of how we're supposed to observe Shabbos, the Torah tells us, Shavu ish tachtav al yetze ish mimekomo bayom hashvi. What does that mean? It means that we have a malacha on Shabbos of Hotzah. Hotzah means I'm not allowed to carry something from one domain to another. I can't bring something from a Rishus HaYachid to a Rishus HaRabim, or in the opposite direction. So how do we know that? We learn that from the Pasuk in Parshas Beshalach. Now, why does the Torah specifically mention Hotzah? It's one of the 39 malachas. Of course, I have to make sure not to violate the malacha. The answer that's given is because Hotzah is a malacha kala, which means Hotzah is the most uncomplicated, basic, effortless activity of any of the malachos. Hotzah, I would have said, all the other 38 malachos are something happens as a result of what I just did. Bishul means I took something that is not edible, and I now changed the status of that item to be an edible item. I took something that was a hard piece of metal, and I put it into the fire, and now it's soft. Now I can bend it. The Rambam says that's a malacha bishul. But here, when I'm talking about Hotzah, the item stays the same from the way it was before to the way it is now. So why should that be a malacha at all? I carried something from place A to place B, but nothing changed. The only thing that changed is the location of that item. Why would that be a malacha? Sounds like a malacha kala. It sounds so insignificant. It sounds like nothing really happens, and therefore it shouldn't be defined as a malacha. Come to the Torah to tell me, for whatever reason, that is also considered one of the prohibited activities on Shabbos, even though intuitively I would have said it should not be included in the list. Now, how do we define, how do we designate what the actual list of the malachas are? The answer to that is, we look at what was done at the time of the Binyan HaMishkan, which is really all derived from our parsha, Parshas Vayakel. And from there we learn which kinds of activities are prohibited and which activities are going to be permissible. It's not always the way that I would have assumed. It's not necessarily determined by something which requires a lot of effort or exertion of energy. Say, for example, I have a tissue in my pocket and I walk outside on Shabbos in a community where there's no Erev. So I'm in violation of Hotzah. How much energy did I expend on that? Zero. I was walking outside anyway. I'm wearing my coat anyway. I happen to have a tissue in the pocket. I didn't think about it. It's a malacha of Hotzah. I carry a paper clip in my hand. It's a malacha of Hotzah, even though I'm not really doing much. However, in my house, if I take a chair that's very heavy, I take a couch, and I pick up that couch and move it from one room in the house to the other room in the house, I would have said, that should be a malacha. But yet, since it's inside of my house, in the confines of my Rishus HaYachid, I therefore say that is not defined, it's not determined as a malacha. And the same goes with regard to cooking on Shabbos. If I have something that was already cooked before Shabbos and now I just reheat it, that would not be a malacha. If I take something raw out of the fridge and I heat it up and I cook it thereby by what I'm doing, that would be a malacha. So why is one considered a malacha and one is not? Hard to determine, but that's why we need Chazal to tell us exactly what is considered to be a malacha and what perhaps is not. Say, for example, if I have a leg of a table that falls off on Shabbos, would I be allowed to screw it back in? Shulchan Aruch says, no, you're not allowed to screw it back in. Thank you. What about if I have a table that I need to extend on Shabbos and I want to put a leaf into the table in order to accommodate more guests that I have? Would that be permissible? Yes. What's the difference? Should be the same. Why is there a difference? Shouldn't it be the same? If I'm attaching a leg to a table to make it usable, and I'm attaching a leaf to a table to make it longer and now usable for more people, should be the same thing. And yet the Shulchan Aruch says, based on the Gemara, that one is prohibited and one is permissible. So we have to look at each malacha very carefully and try to determine what is defined as a malacha and what perhaps doesn't even get into the discussion at all. It seems to us as somewhat arbitrary. It seems maybe at random, like totally inconsistent. So how did Chazal, in fact, formulate the list of the lamatas of his malachos? Where did the magic number 39 even come from in the first place? The answer to that can be found in the Gemara Masechet Shabbos, Daf Memtes Amud Aleph. The Gemara tells us as follows. Hardar yasvu v'kami bayelahu. There was a discussion in the Beis Medrash about the following question. Haditnan avas malachas abraham chaser achas. This that we all know, that there are 39 categories of malacha on Shabbos, can I get me? Who said that? Where'd that come from? It's a very fair question. You're telling me that there are 39 malachas? Prove it. Where'd you get this idea from? Who told you that there are 39 malachas? And this is classic of the Gemara. We have to challenge every assumption. We have to find out, what is the source? How do we know that what we all believe to be the truth, what we all believe to be the halacha, how do we know it's true? We have to come to a very good understanding of what the source of the halacha is. So that's what the Gemara's question is. So the Gemara then answers, Amar lehu Rab Chanina bar Chama. He answers, Keneged Avodas HaMishkan. What does it mean, Keneged Avodas HaMishkan? Rashi there writes, if you look through the parshios of what needed to be done in order to have a Mishkan that was functioning, you'll notice that there are 39 different activities that were necessary in order to have a Mishkan. And therefore, from there we learn all of the Malachas of Shabbos. The Medrash writes, what does it mean from all the different times that we have Malacha being done on the Mishkan? The Medrash says, if you look through Parshas Vayakel, you will find that there are 39 different instructions in Parshas Vayakel about the building of the Mishkan. And from our Parsha, we learn the 39 categories. That's where it comes from. That's what the Medrash says. Okay, then the Gemara says, maybe another opinion, Reb Shimon ber Reb Yossi ben Lekunya, interesting name, tells us that we learn it from Melacha, Melachto, Umeleches, Shebatora, Abraham, Chasarachas. If you count up all the times that it says Melacha, Meleches, Melachto in the construction of the Mishkan, you see that it's 39 different times, and from there we learn there are 39 categories of Melacha. Now, the Avnei Nezer has a Sefer on Hilchos Shabbos. That's a very famous and very fundamental Sefer called the Eglei Tal. And the Avnei Nezer, he wonders, is this something that was learned from the building, the construction of the Mishkan, which is outlined in our Parsha? Or is this something that is learned from the ongoing day-to-day activities in the Mishkan? Those weren't always the same. Sometimes you have to do certain things in order to build a Mishkan. Sometimes you have to do different activities in order to have a functioning Mishkan later on. Which one was it? So that's a big discussion in the Avnei Nezer. Either way, what is abundantly clear from all of this is that there is some kind of very profound, resonant connection between Shabbos and Meleches HaMishkan. However we learn it, from Meleches, Melachto, from the 39 times that it's mentioned, from all the different activities that were done, either in the construction of the Mishkan or in the day-to-day activity of the Mishkan, it's very clear that there was some kind of very strong connection that existed between the instruction of Shabbos and how we're supposed to observe it, and the building of the Mishkan or the ongoing function of the Mishkan. And what is that? Why is there a connection? If you look in Parshas Vayakel, the Torah here tells us, right before we have the instruction of building a Mishkan, we're first told about making sure not to violate Shabbos. If you look in Parshas Kisisa on last week's Parsha, right after the Torah tells us that we should build a Mishkan, when it's all finished, then the Torah says, Achas Shabsosai Tishmoru Migdashi Tiro, make sure to observe Shabbos. What is this connection? So Rashi there says, quote in the Gemara, that even though Beis HaMikdash is so important, even though the Jewish people need a spiritual haven for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to reside His Shekhinah in, still, we have to remember that Shabbos is even more important than the Mishkan. And Shabbos would never be overlooked at the expense of building a Mishkan. So Mishkan is important, but Shabbos is even more important. And therefore the Torah says, when instructing us in Parshas Kisisa and Vayakhel about the building of the Mishkan, the Torah has to remind us, don't forget, although building the Mishkan is very important, always remember that Shabbos is even more important, and you have no right to violate Shabbos, even for the sake of building a Mishkan. Gives us a little bit of a context of how important Shabbos actually is. Now, what emerges, as we said, is there's some very powerful connection between Shabbos and Mishkan. Again, it's mentioned in Kisisa together, it's mentioned in Vayakhel together. We learn out all the 39 categories of Malacha from the Mishkan, but one has to explain, what is this connection all about? What is the connection between Shabbos and Mishkan? And some suggest perhaps the connection is that the same way that the point, the objective of the building of the Mishkan was to be able to infuse the world with a sense of sanctity, with a sense of presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so too our job when we observe Shabbos is to infuse our week, the Sheishes Yimei HaMasa, to infuse our entire week, which is often a very profane week, a very indecent week. It's in order to be able to give us an opportunity to do the same thing that we did as a nation when we built a Mishkan. We live in an obscene world, and we require a Mishkan, we require a Beis HaMikdash to re-anchor us, to give us the opportunity to be reminded that there is something greater than all that we see in front of us. And that is the same objective that Shabbos is supposed to play for all of us. Shabbos should be a position in our lives where we have the opportunity to recalibrate, to re-anchor ourselves, to remind ourselves that throughout the Sheishes Yimei HaMasa, throughout the week, whenever we do different kinds of activities and all the people that we may or may not engage with, we have to remember that we can do it all with a sense of purity, with a sense of holiness, with a sense of sanctity, and that is something that is so important for us, but that really is the intrinsic connection between Mishkan and Shabbos. And that is why all the malachas are learned from the Mishkan, because in some way, Shabbos is so intrinsically connected to the building of the Mishkan in the essence of what we want to take away from Shabbos. There is an unbelievable Medrash Tanchuma in this week's Parsha. By the way, if you didn't get it, this week's Parsha is Vayakhel Pekudei. It's a double Parsha. Next week is going to be Vayikra. So there's a Medrash in Parshas Pekudei, which is also this week's Parsha, which makes a parallel and compares the Briya Shamayim Va'aretz, the creation of the world, and the Binyan HaMishkan. So many corollaries are found in the Medrash between the story of the creation of the world and the story of the creation of the Mishkan. Number one, the Medrash says, on the first day of creation, we're told, Bereishis bara Elokim es ha-shamayim ve-es ha-aretz. And the Navi tells us in Barchi Nafshi, we say it on Rosh Chodesh, Notes shamayim ka-yiria, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the sky, it was like a yiria. Oh, where else in Chumash do we have a yiria? Says the Medrash, oh, we're familiar with that term. We have a yiria when HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells us, Ba-mishkan ve-asisa yirios izim. So that's the first parallel. On the second day of creation, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Yihi Rakia, there should be a Rakia, and the idea of the Rakia is Lahavdil, to make a separation, Be'mayim Lamayim. Where else do we have a Havdalah? Says the Medrash, we find it by the Paroches in the Mishkan, V'hivdila HaParoches Lachem, that the Paroches is meant to be a separation between one part of the Mishkan and the part that is Kodesh Kadashim, the part that is further in. Number three, on the third day of creation, the Torah says, Yikavu HaMayim. And in the Mishkan we are told that a very important feature is the Kiyar, which has water in it, that the Kohanim have to use every day. On the fourth day, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Bara Ma'oros, as we're told, Yihi Ma'oros Birkiya HaShamayim. And in the Mishkan we're told that there has to be a menorah, which is also meant to light up the Beis HaMikdash. On Chamishi, the Medrash says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu made the birds. And in the Mishkan, HaKadosh Baruch Hu told us that we have to sacrifice, we have to bring birds as karbanos. In the Mishkan, there were kruvim parsa knafayim lemala, and that also reminds us of the birds. That is what the Medrash says. On the sixth day of creation, HaKadosh Baruch Hu created Adam, and in the Mishkan, we know that we had a Kohen Gadol, says the Medrash, who was supposed to be a representation of everything that Adam was. The Medrash goes on and on and on to make many corollaries between the building of the Mishkan and the creation of the world. So we saw before that there's a corollary between the Mishkan and Shabbos, but now we see that there's a further combination between the Mishkan and Briyas HaOlam. Actually, on Shabbos, when we make Kiddush, we say, that this is not only Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim, but it also reminds us of Bria Shamayim Va'aretz. It reminds us of the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world. So there is some kind of connection between all of this. What is that connection? And how do we understand it? Rav Gedal Yeshua writes in the Sefer Or Gedaliyahu that perhaps what this is all about is the following. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created our world in Sheshes Yimei Bereshis. However, when it came to the building of the Mishkan, HaKadosh Baruch Hu turned to the Jewish people and he says, now I'm allowing you to create the next part of the world. The same way I created everything, now I'm allowing you to get involved. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created all matter, time and space. But now it's our opportunity to use our creative capabilities to cultivate Kedusha in the world. And what we're trying to create is, the same way HaKadosh Baruch Hu built a big world, we're trying to create in some way a microcosm of what spirituality should be in this world. And in some way, that is our opportunity to be similar to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Be it as it may, we know that we have 39 categories of malachos on Shabbos. And the actual malacha is often defined by the way that very activity was done in the Mishkan. Say, for example, we have a malacha on Shabbos of bona. What does bona mean? You're not allowed to build. So what does it mean you're not allowed to build? Well, it depends who you ask. Is there a music class here? Sounds like it? Or that's just someone having fun? So, bona, you're not allowed to build. Now, obviously, we would all agree that if I take bricks, I put cement on top of the bricks, and I build a whole house, that would be a violation of bona on Shabbos. That's not up for dispute. The Yerushalmi has a discussion, what about a binyan l'sha'a? What if I have a temporary building? What if I have a temporary building? So, I plan to build something, but I'm going to take it apart. So, we're not talking about, let's say, Lego, which is so aroy, that's so temporary, it's knocked down right away. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about something which is temporary, but not so temporary. So it's not going to be permanent like a house, but it's not going to be so temporary like Lego, which falls down. So what is the status of that kind of building on Shabbos? Is that a violation of bona? Or would I say, no, that's not constituting the malacha at all. There would be no prohibition at all. That's the question that the Yerushalmi has. The Yerushalmi says that it seems that binyan l'sha'a, even if I do a temporary building, it is called a malacha bona. How do I know? From the Mishkan. Because what was the nature of the building of the Mishkan? It was while they were traveling in the Midbar. So they built the Mishkan, then they took it down, then they put it back up, then they got to another location, took it down again, put it back up. They kept having a temporary building that was put up and taken down. And therefore, from there, the Mishnah says, the Yerushalmi says, we learn, binyan l'sha'a is considered binyan as well. Which gets to a very practical example. There's a famous machlokas between the Noda Yehuda and the Chassam Sofer, two of the great gedolim in the 1800s. The Noda Yehuda and the Chassam Sofer got into a discussion about whether or not you're allowed to use an umbrella on Shabbos. Are you allowed to open an umbrella on Shabbos? Or is that considered to be a prohibition of bona? Well, obviously, the nature of an umbrella is I'm not going to keep it open forever. I'm going to open it. Then when I get into the house, I'm going to close it. Or when it stops raining, I'm going to close it. So that's called a binyan l'sha'a. That's called something that is potentially only being built for a short temporary period of time. Would that be a prohibition of bona or not? Would you say that that's like building a building? Or would you say that that's like building a Lego? So which one is it? That's the big discussion. But so much of that discussion goes around what actually happened in the days of the Mishkan. From the fact that in the days of the Mishkan, it was of temporary nature. The Mishkan was put up, the Mishkan was taken down. Therefore, we learn, we extrapolate from that, that binyan l'sha'a is still referred to as a binyan. Then you have to figure out what falls into that category of binyan l'sha'a. What's called temporary and what's called totally aroy, totally not binyan at all, that would not be a problem. The Mishnah writes in Masechta Shabbos, a very interesting halacha. Mishnah says, if you take an item and you carry it outside on Shabbos, you're in violation of a malacha. What if I take a person and I carry them outside on Shabbos? What would you say? Not sure. My father always says that in the Rav Shir, a lot of people used to hide, not that this is the same, but a lot of people used to hide behind the pole because they knew the Rav was going to call on them. So no one should be scared. What do you say? Take a stab at it. What do you think?
Depends on why you're carrying the person.
Why should it depend on that?
If it's like maybe if it's for, like, obviously if you cook nefesh, you could carry a person. But, like, if you're carrying a baby, like, you can't. I don't think you could. Like, can't you not, like, the same reason you can't push a stroller if there's no air, like, you... carrying a person.
So I would say, hotzah is hotzah. The same way I'm not allowed to carry anything outside, I'm not allowed to carry a person outside. And yet, that is what I would have said. Surprisingly, the Gemara says, if I carry a person who is able to walk on their own, if I carry them outside, perhaps I'm not in violation of a malacha. Why does that make sense? Why should that be true? And the answer to that is, says the Gemara, because we have an assumption, hachai noseas atzmo. When I'm carrying dead weight, when I'm carrying a beam, the beam is not helping me carry itself. I have to carry all the weight myself. When I'm carrying a person, the Gemara says, a live person makes it easier for me to carry because it's live weight. As we know, dead weight is much harder to carry. So Tosis writes over there, and where does that distinction come from? Why should I make such a distinction? It's true. It is a distinction. But it's a chiluk she'ena machalik, right? It is a distinction, but it might be a distinction without a difference. So what's the difference, Tosis says? Because in the days of the Mishkan, what kind of items did they carry? They didn't carry people. When they built the Mishkan, nobody was carrying their friends to do other things. All they were doing was carrying beams, carrying inanimate objects, carrying objects that were dead weight. And therefore we learn the whole understanding of the Malacha of Hotzah has to be comparable to what was in the scenario in the days of the Mishkan. And because nobody was carrying live weight in the days of the Mishkan in order to construct it, therefore that would not be categorized or classified as the Malacha of Hotzah, which is very surprising, but that's what Tosa says. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. I would have said, if it were up to us, I would say it's totally not relevant to the discussion. Carrying is carrying. The chiddush here is that many of the malachos are not just learned from what was done in the Mishkan, but exactly how it was done in the Mishkan. That's really how we categorize the malacha, not just the category, but we also talk about the details of the malacha based on the reality that was in the days of the Mishkan. Yeah. Oh, Meis on Shabbos is a little different. We'll get to that at the end, hopefully. Okay, just remind me in the end. Okay, let's say, for example, the Gemara says in Masechet Shabbos that there's a Malacha Borer. So we know you're not allowed to separate two items on Shabbos. Okay, says the Gemara, you're allowed to be Borer la'alter ochel mitoch psoles biyad. Let's say I have a whole bag of Mike and Ike's, and I only like the strawberry flavor, let's just say. Happens to be I do. So I only like the strawberry flavor and I don't like anything else. So what should I do? Well, there's a malacha borer. So what do I do? Says the Mishnah, no, you don't have to worry. What do? You go in, take out the strawberry flavor with your hand, and you eat it. What do you mean? But isn't that separating? Isn't that borer? Isn't that exactly what the malacha is? So the Rashba says, no, I'll tell you why it's mutter. The Gemara says it's mutter, but the Gemara doesn't explain why. The Rashba says, I'll tell you why. Because that's not a malacha. When you're doing that, that's called derech achila. That's called eating. The same way when I'm about to eat a piece of chicken, I stick my fork into the chicken and I put it into my mouth. So too, when I'm about to eat a Mike and Ike, I put my hand into the bag and I take out what I want and I eat it. That's not called a malacha, that's called achila. And what we talk about from the days of the Mishkan was malacha. We're not talking about achila. Of course, people in the days of the Mishkan also ate, but that was not part of the preparation necessary for the Mishkan to have been built. And therefore, the whole Hagdarah, the whole definition of the malacha is based on what was done in the days of the Mishkan. When they did borer in the Mishkan, it was for the sake of a malacha, not for the sake of achila. And similarly, when it comes to the malacha of tochein, we know that the Torah says we're not allowed to do a malacha of tochein. The Gemara says it's one of the lamentas of malachos. Tochein means you're not allowed to grind. Aye, so why am I allowed to eat anything on Shabbos? Why don't you say that when you're eating with your mouth, your teeth are grinding? So what's the heter to eat? So don't say because it's pikuach nefesh. It's not pikuach nefesh. It's derech achila. The Rabbeinu Chananel, one of the Gedolei HaRishonim, writes on the side of the Gemara in Masechet Shabbos Daf Ayin Dalet that the answer is that's not called a malacha. That's not called a malacha because that is called derech achila. A malacha means I'm grinding something up in order to be able to use it. Here, I'm chewing it up with my mouth, and it's true. It has the same result as taking a mill and grinding flour, grinding wheat, and turning it into flour. It may have the same end result that it's going to be pulverized and it's going to be smaller than it was before, but that's not called grinding. That's not a malacha. That's called eating. Same goes, Rashi writes, that korea means you're not allowed to tear something. Rashi says in Masechet Shabbos, Daf Ayin Gimel, that the only time I'm chayiv for korea is if I'm korea amanas litvor. It's only if I rip some kind of article of some garment, some kind of fabric, in order that I should now be able to use it for something else. Why? Because in the days of the Mishkan, says Rashi, why did they rip things? They had big fabrics, and they had to cut them down to size, so they ripped it. Why did they rip it? In order to sew it into something else. They didn't just rip it for the sake of ripping, and therefore Rashi says that korea, shalom anas litvar, if I'm ripping not for the sake of sewing it into something else, but I'm ripping because I like to be destructive. In such a case, maybe that would not be a violation of a malacha. There is, regarding the malacha of hotzah, I'm not allowed to carry something, as we said, from one domain to another. So what defines a rishus harabim? That is a major, major question. A lot of cities have the shaila, because as we know, we build an eruv in many, many of our communities today. But you're only allowed to build an eruv on the assumption that your city is not a rishus harabim midaraisa. If the Torah says that you're not allowed to carry in this location, then an Erev is not going to help you. The only time an Erev helps is when you have a Rishus HaRabim Midirabana. It's only when you have a public space, which is only a public space on a rabbinic level, then we would say that an Erev is going to help me be allowed to carry. But barring that, I'm not allowed to build an Erev. And that's the big discussion when we come to many major cities. I just got a shaila from the chief rabbi in Hong Kong like 2 weeks ago. He wrote to me. They have a big problem with the Erev there. They don't know what to do. Are they actually able to build it or not? And he brought in a big Talmud Chacham to try to figure out whether or not they're able to build an Erev. And he wanted to know what Rav Schechter's opinion, not me, what Rav Schechter's opinion is about whatever they're planning to do. And I read one page, and I was like, totally unacceptable according to my father's opinion. And that's why there's a lot of controversy. How exactly do we define what a Rishus HaRabim is and what perhaps is not is very, very interesting to figure out. However, one clear halacha is that if you have a space which is covered over with a roof, that cannot be defined as a Rishus HaRabim. And there would be no malacha hotzah. It doesn't matter how public it is. It could be a public stadium. But that is not a Rishus HaRabim. Why is it not a Rishus HaRabim? What do you mean? You have 50,000 fans who are coming into the stadium. But it has a roof over it, so therefore it's not a Rishus HaRabim. Why not? The answer is because in the days of the Mishkan, Rashi says, the Gemara says, Rishus HaRabim, they're not have roofs over it. The Rishus HaRabim was the public domain of the Jewish community. Everybody was traveling around, and that was called the Rishus HaRabim, and there was no roof over their heads. And therefore, we learn from the days of the Mishkan how to define the Malacha of Hotzah b'zman hazeh as well. So it's very interesting. Additionally, outside of that, we have another pasuk in which we learn, Shmos Perek Lamed Hei, pasuk Lamed Gimel. In building the Mishkan, the Torah says, Lasos Bechol Malechas Machsheves. We're told that Bezalel ben Uri ben Hur Lamata Yehuda, last week's Parsha, we're told that he was singled out to be the one to be in charge of the construction of the Mishkan. And it says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu Va'amalioso, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave him some kind of intuition, some kind of understanding of how to build a Mishkan and how important that job was. But he was the one who really was the coordinator, the CEO of the whole project. What are we told in building the Mishkan? That everything was done b'meleches machsheves. What does meleches machsheves mean? Everything was calculated. Everything was very deliberate and intentional. Any of you ever had construction done in your homes? Yeah? Now, this is so not my forte. I don't even understand anything about it. We're having construction in my basement now. And when the architect was showing me all the plans, like, oh, do you see this? Do you visualize? I couldn't see anything. I couldn't understand. It's just not something I could wrap my head around. But what I'm amazed at is the people who do understand this and the people who actually do it have every single last detail calculated in advance. I thought it was amazing. When you're drawing out the plans, I have a gutted basement that was an unfinished basement when we bought the house. And when you're sitting and drawing up the plans of how we're going to split up the rooms, you're also planning whether the door is going to go swing in or swing out. Who's thinking about this? And what kind of knob you're going to buy, and what kind of tiles are they going to be, and how is that going to impact the moldings on the outside of the doors, and the painter, and who's coming first, and who's coming second, and when's the electrician going to show up, and when are they going to put the toilet in? It's like, I can't follow all of this. But the people who know what they're doing know exactly how it's supposed to be done. Everything is b'meleches machsheves. Everything is done in a very calculated and deliberate way. And says the Mishnah, says the Torah, that is the same, obviously, when the Mishkan was built. Everything that was done in the construction of the Mishkan was, in a way, of Meleches Machsheves. And therefore, If you do a malacha today that is done b'shinui, if you do it in an unusual, bizarre fashion, a way that you would never normally during any other day of the week do something, or you do something shalo b'kavana, or you do something without intention, or you do something shalo l'shem tikkun, you're doing something which is a destructive or damaging act, all of those would not be defined as a malacha. The Gemara Baba Kama gets into a fascinating discussion about someone who is doing the malacha of Zorea. Not Zorea. Zorea is planting. Zore and Zorea are different. Zorea is Zayin Vav Resh Ayin, which means planting. Chorei Zorea. Zore means winnowing. What's winnowing? Zayin Vav Resh Hay, which means you're separating. So how do you separate? You throw up the wheat into the air, and then you wait for the wind to come, and the wind will blow that which you don't want aside, and everything that you do want will drop down because it's heavier. Okay, that's the malacha of Zore, not to be confused, as I just did, with Zorea. So the malacha of Zore. So the Gemara, in the context of that discussion, has the following question. What happens if I go into my backyard, and I decide, you know, in our community, I don't know how it works in all of yours, they always make announcements Erev Pesach, before Erev Pesach. We have one big communal burning of chametz that is run by the fire department. Everyone should come and bring their chametz there, and you'll all have an opportunity to burn it. Is that standard? Many of your communities have the same thing? I mean, those who live in the same community, I got it. But it makes sense, because it's not so safe for everybody to just light fires in their own backyards, and you don't really know how to put out a fire. Should it be windy, or should something not go as planned, or should a tree end up catching fire? If you have the fire department there, you're much safer. Okay. Now, what happens, says the Gemara, I light a fire in my backyard, everything's under control, I'm roasting marshmallows with my children, everything's great, we're all having a great time, and suddenly, out of nowhere, a wind comes, takes that fire, catches it onto something else, which then catches onto something else, and my neighbor's whole house burns down. Rahman al-Islam, you're right. God forbid. What happens? Am I responsible for that fire or not? What? No. Why are you not responsible? So the Gemara says, assuming that you were doing everything in a responsible way, that's a big assumption. But assuming you had a fire pit, and it was covered over, whatever, and you had a fire extinguisher there, and you were doing everything as it's supposed to be done. You weren't doing anything illegal. And it just so happens, out of nowhere, it wasn't a windy day, so happens, out of nowhere, a wind shows up, comes and blows the fire out of my control, and now makes the neighbor's house burn down, I'm not considered to be responsible. Why? Because the Gemara says, it's not my city day. It doesn't revert back to my action. My action was, I'm sitting here in my backyard making a little fire, everything safe. All of a sudden, God came, took my action, and blew it out of proportion. That's not relating back to me. That's not my problem. That's what the Gemara says. Okay, ask the Gemara if that's the case. How are you ever in violation of the Malacha of Zorah on Shabbos? What is the Malacha of Zorah on Shabbos? Zorah means that I throw something up in the air, then the wind comes and blows part of it aside, leaves the rest here, and with that, I have violated a malacha. How can that be? You're making use of the wind. What did we just say? What did we just say? We just said that if I have a fire in my backyard and the wind comes and helps me out or does something terrible and takes that fire and blows it into the neighbor's backyard and burns something down, I'm not responsible. That means it doesn't relate back to me. It should be the same here. If I throw up wheat on Shabbos and the wind comes along and blows it out of my control, I should say the same outcome, that it doesn't relate back to me and I have not violated a malacha. Shouldn't that be the outcome? Shouldn't that be the answer? Good question. Pretty good. You're not so convinced. Why are you not convinced? Because the answer is obvious. What's the answer?
I mean, exactly.
Well, so what's the answer? The answer is, let's say I was trying to burn down my neighbor's backyard, I just didn't have the gumption to go and light a fire in the backyard. So I decide to go outside on a windy day, and I light a fire and I say, I pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, please. I mean, you're crazy if you do this, so please don't learn from this. But let's say I go outside and I say, it's windy today, perfect opportunity. I'm going to make this look like an accident. I'm going to start a fire here, and hopefully the wind is going to come and blow it into my neighbor. Am I responsible then? Of course I'm responsible then. You were being irresponsible by lighting a fire on a day when it was windy outside, and that was your intention. And therefore over here, when it comes to the Malacha of Shabbos, says the Gemara, Malachas Machsheves Asra Torah. How do we define, how do we determine what's a Malacha and what's not? We go back to what was done in the days of the Mishkan. And what was done in the days of the Mishkan? In the days of the Mishkan, they made sure that everything was done calculated. Everything was done deliberately. Everything was done bekavana, intentionally. And therefore, if my intention in throwing up the wheat is, I hope that the wind is going to come and blow part of this away and allow me to do the malacha as it's supposed to be done, then even though normally the Gemara says that wind is considered an external force and it doesn't relate back to me as far as Nezikin is concerned, when we're talking about a malacha on Shabbos, malachas machshavas is what matters. And like you correctly said, this is my intention. This is what I had in mind, and therefore I'm going to be chayiv. That's why those two cases are not the same. Take for another example. Fascinating halacha in the Rambam. We have a malacha of tzeda on Shabbos. What does tzeda mean? Not allowed to trap an animal on Shabbos. Big discussion whether or not you're allowed to trap a person on Shabbos. So you're laughing. What if a kid is misbehaving and you put them in a room, right? Which is child abuse. Not a good idea. But outside of child abuse, which is, we shouldn't make light of it. It's not funny. Can I put someone in jail on Shabbos? So obviously, if the person is a danger, so of course you do that. But what's the status? So let's stick to animals for now. So we know that there's a malacha tzeda on Shabbos. What does the malacha tzeda mean? So conventionally, tzeda means I go outside. There are wild animals all over the place. I throw out a net. And I know that I'm going to catch an animal. And 5 minutes later, I see the net is all tangled. I pull it back in, and I see that I caught an animal. Great! That's the malacha tzeda. What happens if I put a net into the water, and I know that I'm going to be able to catch fish? That would be malacha tzeda on Shabbos. Okay. Says the Rambam, what happens in the following scenario? I've always wanted to catch a deer. I haven't. But let's say, I always wanted to catch a deer. Last summer, I was asked by Yaha to go visit some of their summer programs that they have in the Catskills. So I said, I'm happy to go. I'm just too exhausted to drive there and back. It's too much driving. I can't do it. If you have someone else that's going, I'm happy to go with them. Otherwise, I'll have to go another time. Fine. They had a whole group from Yaha administration that was going, so somebody drove me. Here we are, literally 2 minutes away from Camp Chaverim. You know what Camp Chaverim is? They have a big Yachad program there, a really impressive program. Literally 2 minutes away. And we were hit by a deer. Literally hit by a deer. The deer hit the front of the car. The entire front of the car was full of deer hairs. It was gross. And the deer just rolled off and died on the side of the highway. There was another Yachad car right behind us. We stopped. I'm like, I thought it was really dangerous to hit a deer and keep driving. We're looking around. Nothing happened to the car. Not a scratch. All there was deer hairs all over the place. But that's not the norm. So somebody in the car behind us is like, oh, awesome, you killed a deer. You want to take it home? I'm like, that is the furthest thing from what I'm thinking right now. And like, if you want to, you're very much welcome to. But say, for example, says the Gemara, that I really would love the opportunity to catch a deer. But I'm a really bad hunter. And I really don't know how to. And deers are very quick. So deer are very quick. So what do? Says the Rambam, I have a great idea. I also own a dog. I'm a pet lover. So I own a scary-looking dog. So what do? I take the dog out with me into the forest. And I make the dog bark so loud that the deer gets so scared. And when I do that, I can then have the dog, because the deer is, you know, they say a deer in headlights. That's exactly what it is. The deer will just freeze. While the deer is freezing, I say to the dog, go get him. And the dog bites the deer's leg. And the deer now can't run. And now I caught the deer. Says the Rambam, you have violated the malach of tzeda. What? How can that be? By screaming at the deer and making it freeze, and then sending the dog after the deer to bite it and catch it, that's called a malacha tzeda? How can that be? How does that relate back to the malacha tzeda, which is conventionally known as taking a net, throwing it outside, and catching a deer? What's the connection? The answer is, says the Mishnah Brura, even though it seems very far removed from that original example of throwing out a net, the truth is, this is derech hatzayadim latzut. If you talk to the real professionals, says the Mishnah Brura, who try to catch deer, I'm sure today this is not the case, but the Mishnah Brura says, if you talk to the professional deer catchers, this is how they all do it. Nobody has the ability to catch a deer. They're too quick. So what do? They bring some animal out. They scare the deer. By scaring the deer now freezes. Then they send the animal to go get it, says the Mishnah Berurah. Since on Shabbos we define a melacha based on melechas machsheves, since it's determined based on what my kavana is, what was my intent when I did this act, therefore this is called a melacha tzedek, because this is how deer hunters usually do their work. So it's true. When it comes to doing a melacha al yedei shinui, we say that that would not be defined as a melacha. However, the problem with that is, it means that all of us can basically have a regular Shabbos as we otherwise would observe any other day of the week, and do everything al yedei shinui. I can press my computer buttons with the back of my fingers. I can turn on the lights with the back of my arm. I can do everything in an unusual fashion, and thereby circumvent the entire experience of Shabbos. And as a result of that, Chazal told us that they made an Isser Dirabbanan. The Isser Dirabbanan is that you're not allowed to do a malacha on Shabbos, even al yedei shinui. Although, based on the prescription that the Torah gives, there should be no prohibition at all, because after all, the Torah says it has to be a malachas machsheves, it has to be done the normal way, it has to be done with intent, it has to be done as a deliberate act, and when I'm doing it al yedei shinui, it doesn't fit that qualification. Nobody in the days of the Mishkan, when they were trying to build it, took a hammer and banged it in with their elbow. Of course not. You wouldn't have a Mishkan that was built normally. So therefore, it really should not be defined as a malacha at all. But Chazal were concerned that if I was going to allow somebody to do all of these malachos, that would be something that would circumvent the entire experience of Shabbos. And therefore, they said that midrabanan, you're not allowed to do that either. Okay. There's actually a fascinating question that the Avnei Nezer asks. When we talk about the malacha of Bishul, so how is Bishul normally done? Put a pot on the fire and you cook something. I'll take a question in a minute. Put a pot on the fire, you cook it. Simple. Okay, says the Gemara, what happens if I have a beating hot sun and I have a pot outside and I crack an egg on the pot and I cook it in the sun? Would that be a malacha of Bishul? Mida everything. Gemara says, heter gummer. Take out the pan for a minute. It's burning hot sun. And I go into my driveway, and the driveway is so hot, and I crack an egg. I don't know who would need an egg off the driveway. But if I crack an egg on the driveway, and it's sizzling hot, and it cooks up immediately because it's in the burning hot sun, says the Gemara, Bishul b'chama is not called Bishul at all. Not midiraisa, not midirabanan, it's heter gummer, no problem at all. So the Avnei Nezer asks, I don't understand, why is that different than all the other examples that we gave? Technically, I'd be allowed to write with my left hand on Shabbos. But the problem is, Chazal said, if we're going to allow everybody to write with their left hand, everyone's going to be writing the whole Shabbos. Technically, I'm allowed to turn on the lights with the back of my arm. The problem is, if I'm going to allow that, everyone's going to go around bumping into the light switches. I'm not going to have Shabbos at all. So Chazal said, if you do something even in an unusual fashion, that's still called an Isser on Shabbos, midirabanan. You're right, it's not a melacha midaraisa, but it's still an Isser midirabanan. So therefore, why shouldn't it follow that when it comes to the melacha of Bishul, it should be the same? What? It's much harder to do everything with the back of my arm.
Yeah, but I don't know, not everything necessarily is a cooking.
That's true, but let's say you can. Not every machine is going to go on with the back of my arm either. Right? So that's the question of the Avnei Nezer. I'm not going to get into the answer, but it's interesting to think about it. Why is it that by every other shinui that we have, and all the other malachos we say, it's not permissible, even al yedei shinui, because midrabanan they said you're not allowed to do it. And yet when it comes to the malacha Bishul b'Shabbos, suddenly we say, oh, no exception to the rule. If you cook normally, on a pot, on the fire, that's called Bishul. If you use the sunlight, that's not called Bishul. Yeah, it's not called Bishul normally, but why don't you say it's the same thing as Shinui for every other Malacha, and it shouldn't be allowed? Okay, that's the question. And the same question is asked, the Beis Yosef asked in the name of the Rishonim, why is it that when it comes to Tochen, if I do Tochen in an unusual fashion, it's not called Tochen? Why don't you say it should be the same as Shinui? Anyway, those are very interesting anomalies, interesting discussions, but not something that we have time to get into right now. Okay, similarly, the Torah says that if I have a malacha that is done, but it's done as a malacha she'ein sricha legufa, and this is what we're going to close with. What is a malacha she'ein sricha legufa? Every malacha in the times of the Beis HaMikdash was done with a particular outcome in mind. What was the outcome? You have to think. Why did they do it in the days of the Mishkan? What if I do the exact same activity, but with a different outcome in mind? Say, for example, the Mishnah says in Maseches Shabbos, who mentioned before about taking a dead body outside? I don't remember who that was. You did? So what's the story with taking a dead body? Mishnah Maseches Shabbos in the 10th parak writes as follows. Hamotzi meis l'rishus harabin. Normally, if I carry something from my house to the outside, to the rishus harabim, that's a malach of hutzah. Not allowed to do that. What if I take a dead body from the house? Somebody passes away on Shabbos. I carry the dead body from my house to outside. What's the halacha? Says the Gemara, it's a machlokas tanoim. Why should it be a machlokas tanoim? So the Gemara says, that's a malacha shein tzricha l'gufa. Why? Because I have a totally different outcome in mind. What's the normal outcome that I'm expecting, that I'm trying to get to, when I carry something from inside to outside? I have a beam inside of the house. I have a construction site outside. I need to bring the beam from here to there. That's hotza. I need it to get from place A to place B. Here, when I have a dead body in the house, I don't care if it's inside or outside. I would actually much rather it be inside, because I don't want it to decompose in the sun. Only problem is the whole house smells. So I need to figure out how to get it out of the house. If I had another way to get the house not to smell, I would do that. So therefore, my intention, when I'm doing the very same action of carrying something from inside the house to outside of the house, it's the same thing, but it's a malacha shein tzricha l'gufa. I'm not doing this because I want to move something from place A to place B. I'm doing it only because I don't want this to be in place A. And therefore, the Mishnah has a discussion whether that would be permissible or not, because that is a malacha shein tzricha l'gufa. Take for another example. Choresh. Choresh means I'm digging into the ground. What's the normal intention when a person digs into the ground? Well, in the days of the Mishkan, they did that because tzarech la'afara. We need dirt for the construction site. So we dig into the ground in order to be able to use the dirt for something else. What if a person does it today, not because you want to be able to use the dirt, but rather because you're just making a ditch in the ground? Now, most regular people don't want to have a ditch in the ground. People are going to trip on it. But that's what you're doing. That's called a malach hashein tzvich l'gufa. Shulchan Aruch in Simon Shin Aleph talks about the following case. When we talk about the malach of hotzah, hotzah means I'm carrying something because I want to carry that item from place A to place B. What happens if you have somebody who has some kind of emission from their body? So you have a woman who wants to wear a hygienic pad, or you have somebody who has a nosebleed and they want to put cotton balls around their nose to make sure that it's not going to get all over the place. So am I allowed to go outside with that on Shabbos? If there's an Erev, of course you can. But if there is no Erev, what's the heter? What's the heter to go outside? So does that mean every time somebody has an emission from their body, I'm going to be very embarrassed if I'm going to go outside without a pad? It's going to get all over the place. So what should I do? I should stay home the whole Shabbos every time I have that situation? Of course not. Shulchan Aruch says no. In that situation, that is not called hotzah. Why? Because the reason why I'm wearing this is not because I want to bring it from place A to place B, but rather because I don't want to get dirty. I don't want the nosebleed to spread. I don't want anything else to happen. I don't want to get dirty from whatever is coming out of my body. And therefore we assume, since I have a totally different intention by the action that I'm doing, even though it's the same, this item is going from place A to place B, the same way if I did hotzah with anything else, it would go from A to B. It's called a malacha shein tzricha l'gufa. And the Shulchan Aruch says that would be permissible. The Isser on Shabbos of netilas neshama. What is netilas neshama? It means you're not allowed to kill an animal. Now, in the days of the Gemara, in the days of the building of the Mishkan, why would they kill an animal? Not because we hate animals, but rather because they needed to use the skins, the hide of the animal, for the construction of the Mishkan, for the Urios. So let's say I'm killing an animal not because I want to use the skin, but rather because I'm scared of the animal, or because the animal is really annoying me. I have a mosquito here, and I'm afraid it's going to bite me. I have a bee here in the sukkah. I got to get rid of it. So I'm killing it. I'm doing the same action as Netilas Neshama, but it's for a totally different reason. Not because I want to use it, but because I don't want it to bother me. That's called, as the Shulchan Aruch says, a malacha she'en tzricha l'gufa, or a very common example. There's a malacha of tolish, which means you're not allowed to separate davar migidulo. That generally means, if I want an apple from a tree, I'm not allowed to pull it off on Shabbos, because that would be oker davar migidulo, taking something from the place where it is grown, and now detaching it to use for a different purpose. However, what if a person has a loose tooth, that is causing them agmas nefesh on Shabbos, it's uncomfortable, it's bothering you. Would I be allowed to take the tooth out on Shabbos? It's oker dover migidulo. I'm detaching something from the place where it naturally grows inside of my mouth. I know it's a strange application from a tree with an apple, but it's the same. But I'm doing it for a totally different purpose. It's not because I want to use the tooth. It's rather because the tooth is causing me so much pain. What? Chola she'esh basakana. Somebody's tooth is loose. It's not a chola she'esh basakana. No. If they're in a tremendous amount of pain, it's different. Let's say it's uncomfortable. It's bothering me a lot. So would I be allowed to do that? It's not a sakana. Right? You wouldn't go to the hospital if your tooth was loose during the week. Would you?
It could get infected.
It could. But tell me the truth. If you were on your way out to work one day and your tooth was loose, would you go to the hospital or would you go to work?
You
go to work.
You would take it out. You would pull it out.
Correct. So therefore, the reason why I'm detaching this is not because the same reason why I detach an apple from the tree because I want to eat it, but rather because I don't want my mouth to be in pain. And as a result of that, we assume that is also defined as a malacha shein tzricha legufa, which doesn't match up to what was in the days of the building of the Mishkan, and therefore it would not be defined as such, and it would take on a very different status as far as malacha on Shabbos is concerned. So this is a general overview of malachos, all of which we learn from our parsha and parshas Vayakel, a very rich discussion throughout the Gemara Masechah Shabbos about exactly how to define malachos and how perhaps not, but something that is extremely relevant to all of us. As the Mishnah Berurah writes, every single Shabbos, we all have to be very, very well aware of how the malachos apply and how they are relevant to all of us today. And it's important for us to be very familiar with all the different complexities of the malacha and how they compare or perhaps differ from what was in the days of the Mishkan, and how that will make a difference to us halacha l'maisa today as well. Okay.